Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story, an epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 12, Captivity. Lionheart had a final look at Syria's slanting gold and apricot dusk from Acre's walls on October 8, 1192. He was alone. Berengaria, along with Richard's sister Joan, Isaac Comnenus's captive daughter, and the greater part of Richard's surviving army, had sailed a week before. Most of the convoy was on its way to England, but the two Plantagenet women, apparently fond of each other's company, were traveling together to Rome and an audience with Pope Celestine. For his part, looking toward the western horizon as a thin shell of a moon hung in the sky, Richard expected to reach his kingdom by Christmas, landing at Marseille, and then managing a quick march across his French lands before winter weather was too advanced. It was time and past time to go home. The Plantagenet government in England, arguably the most essential cash cow in Richard's empire, was struggling, with de Longchamp and Lackland stalking each other like assassins. Fights had broken out in Lincoln, Tickhill, Nottingham, and along the flammable Welsh border. Richard made a determined effort to stabilize things, choosing one of his father's advisors, a highly regarded old churchman named Walter de Coutances, to play referee. De Coutances, possessed of those qualities so beloved by absent monarchs, loyalty, intelligence, honesty, and an admirable work ethic, was sufficiently respected that he could keep an uneasy peace between the two belligerents. Indeed, Lionheart trusted de Coutances enough to give him a secret order that, if things warranted, de Coutances could set de Longchamp aside and take the role of justiciar for himself. What Richard hadn't counted on was a new actor suddenly leaping to the stage, his illegitimate half-brother Geoffrey. Geoffrey had paid 3,000 gold pieces to be named to the prestigious Archbishopric of York, the point being that his bishop's mitre supposedly ended any ambitions he might possess to become a king himself. As an additional curb on unseemly strivings, Richard had insisted that Geoffrey promise to stay out of the country for 3 years. Geoffrey, however, was a Plantagenet. Vows meant so little when they stood in the way of personal interest. With Richard away and no signs he would be returning anytime soon, Geoffrey showed up on English soil, driven by his understandable desire to take control of the archbishopric's significant revenues. De Longchamp, publicly humiliated by Prince John's illicit return, decided he'd make a lesson of the bastard brother. But his people bungled the affair. Stories swept across the country that Geoffrey had been savagely manhandled by bullies under the direction of the king's despised chief minister, the Archbishop's head bouncing across the stony pavement as he was dragged off to a cell in Dover Castle. 20-year-old memories of Thomas Becket were still vivid. People were outraged. De Longchamp's misstep was tailor-made for John, who headed to London at the head of his own army to take control of the government. The two had a dramatic public confrontation in the city, De Longchamp noisily defiant but reportedly pale and evidently frightened. He had no staying power, this clumsy braggart. He might be Richard's chancellor, but he was quickly deposed and banished, fleeing England in fear for his life. The story is that he tried disguising himself in women's clothes as he headed for the beach at Dover in search of a fast boat to France. He hadn't had time to think that particular stratagem through. A lone figure in skirts at the seashore was a riveting curiosity to loitering fishermen and sailors. A situation ripe with all sorts of possibilities, particularly given that the royal minister spoke no English. De Longchamp managed to get out of the country, but his tattered reputation took another massive hit from the vaudeville show of his departure. Fortunately, the management vacuum he left behind was filled immediately. De Coutances took over the regency on the basis of his commission from Richard, while John, buoyed by his success in ridding England of De Longchamp, made a national tour during which he freely shared frightening predictions that if Richard wasn't dead already, it was highly unlikely he'd ever get back from the East. Thinking men were genuinely worried, since Richard's death would almost inevitably mean civil war between Lackland and Arthur of Brittany. And civil war meant more years of fire, starvation, death, ruin. For his part, Lionheart's optimistic plans to make it to England by Christmas failed dismally. A friendly ship crossing his path in the Mediterranean recognized his flag with its three rampant lions, and trumpeted word that Marseille might be a poor choice as a homecoming port. Richard may well have been Europe's greatest soldier, but he would be coming ashore with just a handful of men. And the Count of Toulouse, who had famously stayed behind during the Crusade, was reportedly interested in a chance to slap at his hereditary enemy. Lionheart decided not to try his luck, turning away from Marseille. There weren't many other places that could put him close to his Norman or Angevin bases. Most Spanish ports were held by Muslims, although remote Barcelona or Lisbon might work. He wasn't likely to try directly for England, given that he could only reach it by way of the monster-churned wintry Atlantic with its 60-foot waves. Italy's western coast, where Genoa and Naples hung their waterside torches, was much too close to the home territory of murdered Conrad of Montferrat, a crime a great many people attributed to Richard. Given his choices, Lionheart decided to turn back toward the Adriatic Sea, off Italy's eastern coast, counting on reaching his own lands by way of Saxony, the territory of his friend and brother-in-law, Henry the Lion. Henry's wife Matilda, Richard's older sister, was dead by now. But Henry, who had been close to the Plantagenets for decades, hadn't remarried. Saxony would certainly be welcoming if Richard could dodge a great many Austrians who didn't much like him. It was a risk Richard was ready to take. After all, the Pope himself promised that all Christians would guarantee safe conduct for returning crusaders. The inevitable happened not once, but twice in the wild November seas off the Italian coast. If not actually wrecked, Richard was twice forced ashore to escape storms and repair damage to his torn and leaking ship. The first time he made it to the southernmost reaches of what's now the Croatian coast, near Dubrovnik. Perhaps attuned to what had happened in Messina when Richard had landed there 2 years before, the natives were remarkably friendly, helping with repairs, and in turn being gifted with Lionheart gold, which, according to legend, went to build a new cathedral. Despite this contribution to the spiritual good of Dubrovnik, Richard's luck was to run out again. This time, he made it to the northern end of the Adriatic before he washed ashore, in wilderness off to the northeast of Venice, near Trieste. This second disaster was genuinely a bad one, as it put him in the way of Duke Leopold of Austria, one of the few men in the world who both loathed Richard and had the resources to do something about it. Leopold evidently held a vivid memory of his flag being ripped from the walls of Acre after the epic city fell. That face-on insult could be traced specifically to Lionheart and Lionheart's men. And there was more. Far more. It would happen that Leopold had family ties through his mother to the Comnenus family, which Richard had knocked off the throne in Cyprus. Thanks to the thick medieval knot of noble intermarriage, Leopold was also related to Conrad of Montferrat, warrior prince of entwined grandeur and tragedy. Conrad's shocking murder was something a great many people laid at Richard's door. Hostility toward Lionheart wasn't limited to Leopold. The Duke owed allegiance to the Holy Roman Emperor, ruler of Germany. That imperial power had jealously watched the rise of the Plantagenets, given that there was so much to be jealous about. The two countries had separate spheres in Europe, but it didn't escape envious German notice that the Plantagenets were rich and well-armed, possessed of alliances stretching from Scotland to Cyprus. Then, too, Richard's family intimate and intended host, Henry the Lion of Saxony, had been a major thorn in the Emperor's side for years. There were the self-evident Plantagenet ambitions in Sicily, wealthy Sicily, that trading powerhouse in the Mediterranean that Germans fondly believed owed deference to Germany. Back in the day, Joan Plantagenet had married into the Sicilian royal family. There had been no Plantagenet babies born of that marriage, for which the Germans could be grateful. But then Richard had swept into the country and allied himself with the usurper Tancred. Lionheart had even had the audacity to reach into the next generation by pledging his nephew Arthur to Tancred's daughter, after which he sailed off with trunks filled with Sicilian gold. This was dangerous stuff. When it came to Sicily and Tancred, the Plantagenets were cutting very close to the bone as far as the Germans were concerned. Their Empress Constance happened to be the only living legitimate descendant of the Sicilian royal family. She had lost the throne to her anti-German bastard cousin Tancred only after a vicious Sicilian civil war. The mental agony endured by the German Emperor, Henry VI, husband to the rightful heiress, at being deprived of her superb inheritance, had to be intense. For Richard, stumbling anywhere in Henry VI's territory would be a very bad idea. There are varied stories about what happened to Lionheart in the days after he was forced ashore the second time. Cold, bruised, tired, wet, he had to start making his way north towards Sanctuary in Saxony. Traveling through rough terrain that could turn very hostile very suddenly. People in these borderlands loyal to the Emperor certainly had heard the rumors floating around the Adriatic that Richard had been forced ashore. The hunt was on. Given Richard's unusual height, red hair, and what must have been the eye-catching, muscled frame of a lifelong fighting man, eluding curious gazes wasn't going to be easy. He got as far as he did by disguising himself and the three or four men he kept with him. After all, his family had something of a history of using disguise to get out of tight spots, going back to the days of his grandmother Matilda. His own mother had tried to evade Henry Plantagenet by dressing as a man in the days of the Great Revolt 20 years before. Well, It hadn't worked for his mother, and it only worked for Richard for a time. He managed to hide in plain sight for several weeks, possibly as a merchant traveling with servants, possibly as one among a group of pilgrims, possibly as a Knight Templar with his men. There were several close calls in this era when passing strangers were noticed, watched, and often sharply questioned. Although whether awed by his actual presence or uncertain what to do with him, locals who may have guessed who he was let him go at least twice. However, the occasional helping hand couldn't fix the weather, which was bad, or his exhaustion, which spiraled into fever that forced him to rest. Ultimately, he was found out and arrested at an inn near Leopold's capital, Vienna, still some 200 miles from Henry the Lion's territory. There are a dozen stories as to what happened. He may have tried to gain safe passage from a local baron by concocting a story about being part of a group traveling with the famous crusader Baldwin of Bethune. This regrettably alerted everyone in the area that something interesting was going on, even if all they wanted was a look at the celebrated Baldwin. Some say Richard had taken a local boy as a guide and translator, a naive child who soon got himself caught and gave Richard away. Some say Lionheart forgot to take off the kind of ring only a prince would own. Some that he casually tucked into an expensive meal far out of line with his supposed station in life. One story even makes out that he tried to hide in the inn's kitchen, disguised as a cook. Whatever happened, it was probably inevitable, given that the most famous man in the world was a fugitive traveling a long way in enemy territory. It would have been far more remarkable if he'd actually made it home. And so Richard Lionheart was Leopold's captive. It was Christmastide, 1192. French and German crusaders had already been through Vienna on their way home, telling sour stories of their days in Syria under Richard. Leopold accordingly defended his arrest of a sovereign king by accusing Richard of charges that ranged from the murder of Conrad of Montferrat to the insult suffered by Leopold himself back in Acre. The Plantagenet king was now a pawn in a long game that would be played out between Leopold, the Holy Roman Emperor, Pope Celestine, Philip Augustus, John Lackland, and Eleanor of Aquitaine. Richard spent his first 2 weeks of captivity in Leopold's Dürstein Castle, high above the Danube, where people still climb a mountainside cut with stone steps to see the old ruins. The Duke, a dutiful vassal, if no doubt a highly excited one, then took his famous hostage in person to the Emperor, Henry VI, who had already had the presence of mind to let Philip Augustus know of the vastly interesting events unfolding in his country. As things went, while Leopold may have been dutiful, he was no simpleton. This man, who had wanted his share of crusader gold after Acre fell, also expected his share of the profits to be gleaned from ransoming Lionheart. Emperor and Duke dickered back and forth for weeks. The extended negotiations made Leopold increasingly fretful about what to do with his tar baby. He began to fear the Pope's response to his tampering with a crusader, given that all crusaders were under the Church's protection. He was right to worry. The Pope would excommunicate both Duke Leopold and the Emperor when word of Richard's detention got to Rome, although what the Pope did not do was make war on the two of them, despite sneering allusions from various quarters about Rome's cowardice. And in addition to his worries about Rome, Leopold had solid reason to suspect that his liege lord Henry was not above simply snatching Richard out of his hands. Richard was sent back to safekeeping in Austria, while talks with the Emperor ground on. Now that Emperor Henry VI had entered the scene, it's time for us to get some understanding of this ruler, still in his 20s. A pale, slender prince, the physical opposite of the royal captive. He's intelligent, educated, and a poet. A bit chilly and shy with people, yet a patron of the arts, a legal scholar, a linguist, a composer of music. However, this young intellectual's refined interests belie a man made of pretty stern stuff. In addition to waving away the papal excommunication hurled at his head over Richard, there are gruesome stories about his behavior during the Sicilian Civil War, where he believed in the benefits of burning, blinding, and castrating prisoners, including children. Like Richard, Henry probably never expected to sit on an imperial throne. He was only a second son. His life, too, had been changed by the Third Crusade, which swept away so many European nobles and altered so much dynastic history. The Crusade hit his family hard. His father, Frederick Barbarossa, drowned on the way to Syria, while his older brother, Frederick of Swabia, died at Acre Camp. Taking over as ruler of the Holy Roman Empire in 1191, Henry's attentions were fixed on Sicily, that golden kingdom riding the great sea trading routes of the Mediterranean. He held the firm belief that he and his wife, Empress Constance, ought to be ruling Sicily themselves, given her direct descent from the Sicilian royal family. The bad news was that the Sicilians disagreed. Sicily was of a piece with the rest of Henry's life, battered by a nasty array of royal problems: rebellion at home, rebellion in the provinces, trouble with the church, threats from rivals like the King of Hungary to his south. Just recently, he was thought to have had a hand in the murder of the Bishop of Liege, an incident which had roused screaming anger across half of Germany. Indeed, just as Richard entered his life, the harassed Henry had been forced to speed home from a Sicilian campaign to deal with a German rebellion, one launched by none other than Richard's brother-in-law, the Lion of Saxony. In the disorganization of the German retreat through Italy, the Empress, who had accompanied her husband, had been captured and imprisoned by the hostile citizens of Salerno. She was then herded to her native Sicily, to be turned over to her nephew Tancred. The animosity Henry felt toward Richard, a man who had backed Tancred's right to the Sicilian crown, doubled and doubled again. And so Richard, restless, active, unfettered Richard, began a captivity that would last more than a year. There's a popular belief, dating back to the imaginative 18th century, that he was hidden away from the world all that time, found only through the determination of his favorite minstrel, one Blondel, who surreptitiously visited castle after castle in Germany, standing below all those slit prison windows, singing a song that the two had composed in the good old days. Only Richard, the story goes, would know the words. Staring up toward, say, Trifel's castle, one of his lodgings, which clings to the side of a mountain 1,000 feet over your head, makes one very doubtful that this painstaking method would have actually worked. And, in reality, locating Richard wasn't all that hard. Having the living, breathing Lionheart in one's possession wasn't something anyone would choose to keep secret, particularly the thoroughly delighted Holy Roman Emperor. Rather than suppressing this spectacular news, Henry wrote to Philip Augustus about it the first week after Richard's capture, and the French king was no more inclined to passive secrecy about such thrilling information. Two English churchmen, specifically charged with messages for Richard, came upon him pretty readily in late March in what's now south-central Germany. When they found him, Lionheart reportedly was in good spirits, possibly the afterglow of the adrenaline rush that must have accompanied his trial before the German Imperial Council just a week before. The Emperor had publicly charged his fellow monarch with crimes ranging from Conrad of Montferrat's murder to signing treaties with Saladin. not to mention Richard's support for that prime German enemy, Tancred of Sicily. Richard may have been a prisoner, but he wasn't a man easily cowed. He reportedly was so powerfully lucid and ultimately convincing in his own defense that the hostile tribunal was moved to murmurs of admiration. The charges were dropped, and Richard's status shifted from despised captive to something more like an intriguingly unconventional guest, the kind who came with keys to the treasures of the Plantagenet Empire. Exactly how deep and wide those treasures were was something Henry and Leopold were about to find out. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knabb. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again, February 24th, for the next episode of Lion's Forge. Available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.